From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. What do you say to a breathless press agent who calls with the news that Robert Redford ordered linguine last night at a New York restaurant? If you're New York gossip columnist Susan Mulcahy, you let it pass because it's boring. Besides, the really good gossip comes out of the New York delis. Today on Fresh Air, we talk with one of New York's most read gossips. Also today, I speak with novelist Michael Tolkien. His first book is a revenge fantasy about a glib Hollywood production executive who says no to one scriptwriter too many. Lloyd Schwartz reviews Peter Sellers' update of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, and guest commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book on the SATs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The New York Post is the tabloid that has become infamous for its sensationalistic headlines, such as 300-pound giant seized in sex attack and headless body found in topless bar. It was at the Post that Susan Mulcahy got her start writing gossip, reporting for and then editing the Post's Page 6 gossip column. Now she edits a similar page at New York Newsday. Mulcahy is not expecting to get the Pulitzer Prize, but she's proud of stories that were broken on her page, like Jerry Hall's pregnancy with her first child by Mick Jagger, and the romance between Sean Penn and Madonna, plus more serious stories, such as Mobil Oil's boycott of the Wall Street Journal. Mulcahy is so protective of her sources, when she kept a diary, she wrote her sources' names in code. She's written a new memoir. It's titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. I asked her to describe the Page 6 gossip column she used to edit at the New York Post.
Well, it's pretty infamous in the world of gossip because it's got a much different style than traditional gossip columns. It's not, and the column I do for New York Newsday, Inside New York, is similar to Page 6. It's actually, some people refer to it as the Page 6 of Newsday, but it's a bunch of short stories. It's not, and they're written in the third person in a very irreverent tone, and it's not kind of a chatty first person column like the ones that people think of when they think of traditional gossip columns, like Hedda Hopper, Luella Parsons, whatever. And the Page 6 kind of columns focused, helped sort of break open the term celebrity to include all sorts of people that you wouldn't think of when you start to define celebrity. The Lee Iacocca's and the Carl Icahns and, I mean, political and legal figures, not just movie stars. I don't know, sometimes I think it's not such a good thing that the definition of celebrity has been so expanded so wide open, because it gets a little bit ridiculous. You get into your celebrity car mechanic repair people, and I mean, it's just celebrity everythings.
Well, listen, even you found when you got to the Post that you were expected to write about people who were celebrities, but these were people you'd never heard of.
Right. Well, I didn't really, before I started working at the Post, I was sort of my own. I read the New York Times every day. I didn't really read the tabloids. I had never really read a gossip column before. But I read People magazine. I knew Princess Grace was a celebrity. I knew who the Kennedys were. I knew my favorite movie stars. But they would talk to me, okay, let's get this story. Dick Snyder's doing a big deal with Random House. Da-da-da. I'm like, who's Dick Snyder? You moron, he's the head of Simon & Schuster. Oh, okay, fine, sure. I mean, I had no idea who any of these players are in the Manhattan power game. Like, if you walk into the Four Seasons, which is the big power lunch spot, the grill room anyway, at lunch, I mean, I walked in there, I didn't know who anybody was. Now I walk in there, I still don't know who a lot of them are, but I can point out, you know, I see, always recognize people like Henry Kissinger, but I'll see Cy Newhouse, who's the head of the Condé Nast, the Newhouse publishing fortune, and I recognize him, and I'll recognize Michael Korda, the editor and writer from Simon & Schuster, and Philip Johnson, the architect. And these are all people that I had no idea who they were.
Given how little you knew about the celebrities you were supposed to be covering, how did you end up writing gossip?
Well, I sort of really did fall into it. I was going to school at Barnard in New York, and I was waitressing for the summer. I thought I was going to be waitressing. This was about 10 years ago, and somebody that I was going to school with worked as a clerk at the New York Post and said, why don't you try out getting a job as a copy girl? And I thought, well, you know, as a waitress, I was very experienced in getting coffee, and that's probably what the main duty of a copy girl was, so I could handle that. And then I'd only been at the Post 3 or 4 weeks, and they needed somebody to be an assistant on Page 6. I mean, I don't think anybody would turn down the opportunity to do a job like that for, say, a couple of months. It would be fun, a kick, something different. I didn't know that 10 years later I would still be doing it, but it's one of those things where every couple of years the whole job definition and my responsibilities changed. You know, I was an assistant for 2 years, and then all of a sudden, boom, I was the reporter, and then I did that for 2 years, and then I was the editor. So my job changed with such regularity that it never got boring, and I stuck with it. So it's been fun.
When you got there, what were the stories you were shown to show you the kind of writing you would be expected to do, or the kind of writing that would be best for this page?
Well, the first person that I worked for, I think, had too bitchy a style. She would, the way she wrote, she always stuck the knife in. She loved to write about people on diets. She'd go, you know, Marlon Brando, who's forever climbing up and down the stairs, she'd go, well, looking a tad pudgy this week, Marlon. Or, you know, Liz Taylor's checked into a fat farm, so, you know, knock off the malted milk balls, Liz. And she would be really nasty to people. And I'd read these items and sort of cringe at some of the leads and the kickers that end them, because they were so so nasty. We did one on Prince. She loved to write about fat people. Prince Rainier of Monaco, we did an item on Princess Grace and Rainier hiring a new pastry chef. And she ended the item with, he, for one, doesn't need the calories, da-da-da-da. And there was sort of a nasty tone to a lot of the items, really digging the knife in. And I came to learn that you could have fun with people and be irreverent and not necessarily stab them. You could sort of poke fun at them. And I think that's when these columns work, that's the way they work the best.
How about an example of a leader, a kicker you've come up with that shows how you like to have fun with someone but not really at their expense?
Well, I wrote a story on there was a big society wedding up here either last month or the month before. Saul Steinberg, the very wealthy financier, his daughter Laura married Jonathan Tisch. I think it was Jonathan, one of the Tisch sons of the Tisch CBS, that family fortune. Although actually, it was the son of Preston Robert Tisch, the former Postmaster General. But anyway, they had this huge wedding that was the most expensive, most lavish, most ostentatious thing Manhattan's seen in a long time. They spent an estimated $1 million just on the flowers, and that I've heard is an underestimate. So I led off the story with something like, because they spent $9 a piece on these special white tulips. I led off the story with, in our neighborhood, you can get an entire bunch of tulips in all different colors for only $3 or $4 at the Korean fruit stands. Stupidly, we forgot to tell Mrs. Steinberg this, and she went and ordered the special white ones for $9 a piece. And then we went into a whole description of how much the flowers cost and the rather deplorable fact they were thrown out the next day rather than being sent to a hospital or you know, some sort of an orphanage where they would have, you know, cheered up somebody's day. But anyway, I mean, you can do it with sort of going, gee whiz, can you believe this is happening, and make people laugh in a way that's not going to hurt them.
You know? How did you find out how much the flowers cost?
I have my sources. No, it was really, that wedding was unbelievable. I think that was probably the last blast of the Nouvelle Society Reagan overspending. I mean, I can't believe it. Although Donald Trump keeps coming up with new ways to spend more money in ways that people never thought possible. But I hope it's an end to this era. It's really sort of revolting. It's like these people stumble out of their parties across the homeless, you know, while they're... Anyway.
Well, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Susan Mulcahy, and she's written a new book titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. She used to edit the Page Six gossip column of the New York Post and now edits the Inside New York gossip column, or People Page, whatever you,
yes,
whichever you prefer, for a New York Newsday. Now, you describe in your book how when you started writing gossip for the Post, your editor at the time wanted you to call Nora Ephron, who had just had her baby,
right,
and find out how much the baby weighed. And you didn't want to do it. You thought it was a real intrusive thing to do.
Well, it was. I didn't want to call her. First of all, she wanted me to call and get some sort of comment or quote from Nora Ephron, like what the baby's name was. And I've run into this since then. And the way I handle it now that I'm the editor rather than the reporter and assistant is, like, there's no need to call somebody that's in the hospital. We had a story on Harry Helmsley last year having some minor operation. And one of the people I was working with said, oh, he's at, you know, whatever hospital it was, New York Hospital. Let's give him a buzz. I said, forget it. Call his office. There's no need to wake somebody up in a hospital bed. But my boss wanted me to call Nora Ephron up. So I sat there and didn't do it. And finally she forced me to do it. And Nora Ephron was very funny. In retrospect, at the time I was horrified, but she sort of picks up the phone and there's this groggy, hello. And I said, hi, I'm calling from Page Six of the Post. And we heard that you had a baby and we wanted to ask you about it. And there's like this very long pause. And she says, you guys must be pretty hard up for news. And I said, oh, you know, we just wondered what the baby's name was. She told me it was a boy and his name was Max, and she sounded really sick. And then she got off the phone, and my boss says to me, how much did the baby weigh? And I hadn't asked how much the baby weighed. I barely made the phone call. And she said, well, you'll have to call her back. And I faked it. I mean, I couldn't do it to the woman after I'd just woken her up and she sounded so sick. So I stuck my finger on the button on the phone and pretended that I called and made up some number, 6 pounds, 4 ounces or whatever it was, because I I didn't have the heart to call her back again. I mean, it's those kinds of things. It's not, I mean, these things are, gossip columns are supposed to be fun. They can be real informative, but there's no need for them to, I mean, it's not nuclear war you're writing about. You don't need a comment from the person involved in a situation like this. And I felt really bad about doing that to Nora Ephron, but...
Would you still have to do things that you feel bad about doing?
Yeah, occasionally, but I don't really... I'm trying to think of something that I may have felt bad about.
Yeah, tell us something you felt really bad about recently.
Oh, when people's... I always feel bad when you hear rumors about people's marriages breaking up. And even those kinds of stories, I only run them if they're practically in court. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and say, oh, there's a slight problem in such and such a marriage, because if you're not really sure about it and the marriage is not, like, officially breaking up, you may help to break it up if you start printing stuff like that. I had to call John Gutfreund, who's the head of Solomon Brothers here in New York, so these rumors that, you know, he and his wife were breaking up. And that was a very uncomfortable phone call, because you're sort of sitting there like, we heard you were, you know, splitting up. I had to do the same thing with Hugh Carey, the former governor of New York, and his wife, Evangeline Gulaitis, and they have split up. But it was a very, very uncomfortable phone call, and I was cringing while I was asking the questions, you know. And you say to yourself, well, then why do you do those kind of, I ask myself sometimes, why do you do those kinds of stories? And because they fit into this kind of a column. You know, I don't do that many of them, but I do them once in a while. But I'm very certain when I run it that they're really true, because you can just hurt people too much if they're not.
In the days of columnists like Hedda Hopper, gossip columnists could really make or break people's careers. They could ruin people if they wanted to, and I think they sometimes did. Do you think that gossip columnists still have that kind
of
power?
No, they really don't have that kind of power anymore. TV's really the medium now that can make or break people. That's why there are so many different kinds of celebrities, because TV can take somebody like, that little girl, Jessica McClure in Texas, I mean, that would always be a big human interest story. But she was, like, turned overnight into this huge celebrity. It's television. As soon as you put somebody's face on TV and splash it all over the country, they're an instant celebrity. Gossip columns don't have that kind of power anymore, although it's funny in what ways they do make an impact. There's an anecdote that I relate in the book about a gossip column. I mean, it appeared in page 6 about one of these, about Ortega of... Nicaragua, which is sort of a weird person to be writing a gossip column about, but I've actually written a number of items about him, because when he comes to New York, he tends to dine at places like the Russian Tea Room, which I find sort of strange for somebody like Ortega. But anyway, he was here with his wife, and we ran a short item on page 6 about them going to an optical store on, I think it was Madison Avenue, and spending some $3,500 on eyeglasses, designer eyeglasses, special bulletproof eyeglasses. And every place in New York, everybody in New York has a press agent, it seems to me, most of the time. They're always pushing them, their clients. And this item was planted by a press agent who represented the optical store. And I didn't really want to, you know, I hate to run that kind of stuff, but it was sort of an amusing item. So we run it, and the next thing I know, every time there's a reference to Ortega in the papers, it's, you know, the designer in... the dictator in designer glasses. I mean, and this went on and on. There was a huge interview in Playboy with him last year, and it was brought up again. And this eyeglass spree happened 3-4 years ago. I mean, it's very funny. And it was from the page 6 item that all this came up. But that's hardly making or breaking a career. It's just, it is amusing sometimes the way they can have an impact and how a small anecdote will be picked up and repeated over and over again. You know, I'll be at a cocktail party and somebody say, well, I was reading last week, now, isn't that? I'm like, yeah, I wrote it. So it's people love little silly tidbits of information.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot more people who are openly gay or lesbian than there were, say, in the early days of the gossip columns.
Right.
Yet, I think there's still this kind of... unwritten law that you never bring someone out of the closet unless they want to come out themselves. And I was wondering if you observe that in your
Everybody
column.
Everybody does, I think, really. Because that's somebody's personal business. There was an instance a number of years ago, it was 5-6 years ago, of a guy in New York who was the former cultural affairs commissioner who, as a political statement at a public function, came out. And I forget what, I think it had something to do with the gay rights bill. He just announced that he was gay. And that was covered. And it actually appeared in page 6, an item about the event that it took place at. But he wanted to make a statement and he came out. You don't do it for people. I really think that I don't think anybody does that.
How do you handle AIDS stories also? There's always stories circulating that such and such a star has AIDS.
I just don't run them. I got myself into a situation once. There were rumors running all around town about Richard Pryor. And it's just in this day and age, every time somebody starts to look gaunt, Mm-hmm. The rumor mill starts churning. Oh, he must have AIDS, especially if it's someone who's kind of, you know, known to be gay. But Pryor was not. So I was sort of surprised at these rumors. And two other columns in New York printed the rumor. I dropped it because really I just didn't think it was true. I couldn't get any confirmation. And it was too damaging to print without confirmation. So I didn't run it. And after that, it turns out he did not. And at least one of the columns had to print a retraction. And I saw a television interview with him some months later. And he said his life was a living hell for a while after this piece appeared because everyone thought he had AIDS. And he realized what it would be like to actually publicly admit you have AIDS. And people shunned him like he was a leper. And, you know, he had a really rough time. And so I just decided after that I would never, if somebody even called me up, because some people call me up and say, I hear so-and-so has AIDS, I don't even make a phone call on it, because even if I confirmed it, I wouldn't run it. I think that that's also somebody else's business. Mm-hmm. If you know, the family of a person who has AIDS dies and they want to put it in the obituary, that's their business. So, I mean, I don't think gossip columns should play that sort of role.
When you decide that you don't want to run something because it violates your ethics, do you ever get pressure either from editors to run it anyways, or do you feel pressured knowing that your competition's going to get it, even if you don't print it, so it's going to be public one way or another, you might as well go with it?
No, well, I see. There's a story actually today on page 6 of the New York Post about a very famous or a very wealthy Manhattan businessman who is having an affair with a young actress slash model. He doesn't mention the businessman's name, but he mentions the model slash actress's name and runs her picture. And I found that very interesting, and I'm sure everybody else that reads the column will too, but I wouldn't have run it.
Why not?
I don't know. I just think you're really treading on very uncertain ground there when you start getting into running who's having an affair with whom. He doesn't mention the businessman's name, which is sort of fascinating, but it's one of those things where people are going to start playing guessing games now, and I don't know. I wouldn't have run it, but I know a lot of people are going to be interested to read that item, and they're going to start trying to figure out. That's actually a sort of a semi-blind item, which very few columns run those anymore, when you run which famous producer was seen with which, you know, lovely showgirl at they used to run those all the time, but blind items have gone out of fashion, really. But I wouldn't have run that. I don't really get that much pressure, though, and my editors particularly at Newsday, are pretty good about that. Nobody really forces stories down my throat.
Are Liz and Jackie still considered good copy? That is, Liz Taylor and Jackie Onassis.
Oh, Jackie, the best copy are people who don't want to be written about. If I could get a good Greta Garbo scoop, I'd run it in a minute. The people that are out there publicizing themselves and are real easy to write about, sure, you can do them once in a while, but it's no challenge. Even the movie stars who are not completely inaccessible, like the Woody Allens and the Robert Redfords, who, you know, they're available for press once in a while, they're much more fun to write about than somebody who's out there, you know, flacking themselves to death, because it is a little bit harder to get something on them. But Liz Taylor will always be fascinating because she's like the last of the movie legends. There's nobody else left like her.
Do you really care about her?
I find her a fascinating character because I think she's not one of those people that became a celebrity when they were in their 20s. Like, she grew up in the public eye. I think she's a really fascinating character. But do I really care, like, whether she gained 5 pounds? Do I really, really care?
Well, do you?
No, I really don't. I care more whether I gained 5 pounds. It's still fun, though. I mean, she was at a film festival once that I went to in France, and it was hysterical to watch people chase her around. You would think that the second coming had occurred. It was really entertaining. I feel kind of bad for her. I wouldn't want to be in her shoes, but it was pretty funny. Lise, Lise, oh, I love you. You know, all these crazy French people running around screaming and yelling at her. It was, I got a big kick out of it.
I want to talk with you more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Susan Mulcahy, and she's the author of a new memoir titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. And she used to edit the Page 6 gossip column for the New York Post, and now edits a similar page in New York Newsday, which is called Inside New York. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about gossip with gossip columnist and editor Susan Mulcahy, author of the new book, My Lips Are Sealed. Let's talk about how you get your stories. As you've said, you have your sources. Now, some of those sources are publicists,
Some of them,
right. What's the difference between a good and a bad publicist in the way they'll pitch a story to you?
Well, the bad publicist, and I hate to say this, 90% of the people in the profession fall into that category, are the ones that they don't know what kind of story you need, because a lot of the time they don't even read the columns. And this isn't, you know, this happens to every journalist. Somebody will call up and start pitching you a story and say, well, I mean, I have people call me with stories about, you know, sporting events and, you know, garden club listings. And I say, do you read the column? This is not the sort of thing that we run. But good publicists are the ones that know what you need and help you out with things that are unrelated often to the clients that they work with, so that when they do need a favor for a client, you're more willing to say, sure, let me see if I can fit in a story about that. Bad publicists, there's some of them, this guy calls me up and he's always pitching stories about what happened at various restaurants, and he'll call up and say, you know, Robert Redford came in last night, and he had a linguine. I'm like, oh, my God, stop the presses. Let me get the editors with this. We should get this on the front page. And he doesn't – I try to explain that, you know, there are a lot of celebrities in New York, and they all go out to restaurants every night. And just the fact that somebody ate at a restaurant, it isn't a story. If something happened while they were there that's newsworthy, fine. But it, just the fact that somebody went out to dinner at a restaurant is not a story. And that's, I swear to God, that's half my calls are people calling up telling me that celebrities ate at restaurants.
Well, so in New York, don't all the restaurants and all the delicatessens...
They all have press agents.
They have their own press agents.
But certain people, if they have the right sense of humor, like I love to write about the New York delis because the press agents for the delis are so funny. There was a guy who's actually retired now who represented the Carnegie Deli and the Stage Deli and a number of others for quite a few years. And he would come up with the most lame, unbelievable publicity stunts to get what he would refer to as a column mention thal. You know, he'd call him and say, we have heart-shaped matzo balls in the soup for Valentine's Day. What do you say, thal? Column mention? And it just, he was so funny. I couldn't resist, and I would run all these items. We finally had to stop it because he was coming up with the most absurd shaped matzo balls for every possible holiday. But he would do busts and chopped liver of people, and I found them so entertaining that that's sort of a part of New York lore, the delis, the Carnegie Deli.
You know, well, you have a deli story from just a few days ago.
That's right. I love the matzo ball soup.
Oh, and also that Jackie Mason is on the outs.
Oh, yes, there's
the,
a big
the Carnegie
feud
deli.
Going on with the Carnegie Deli.
Right.
Big feud.
Now, you are an editor as well as a writer.
Right.
So it's really your responsibility to make sure that all the facts are
right.
Accurate and that you're not going to get sued for libel.
Yeah, I have two terrific reporters that work with me, Karen Freifeld and Michael Fleming, and they work on their own stories or they follow through on tips that I assign them sometimes. And at the end of the day, I go over people's stories and edit the column and put it together.
Have you ever been sued?
Nope. I've received, people get annoyed, you know, and they'll might call and yell at me or send letters, but I've never actually had anybody file a lawsuit against me because I am pretty careful.
But when you're writing a story that's not planted by a publicist, but you've gotten a lead on something, and,
right.
And you're going to reveal this in your column, say something that the person would just as soon have kept private. It's not that the facts are wrong, they can't sue you for libel, but they would have preferred that it not be printed.
Well, yeah.
How do you feel about that, knowing that you're making private facts public?
Well, I've come to realize that a lot of the people that say that are really, they're not being 100% truthful. They try and tell you that it's going to ruin their lives if you print it, but a lot of the time it's not even that personal and they just don't want to print it. Sometimes I don't run stuff if people really, they say, look, this chain of events will occur if you run this and it's going to be really disastrous for me. I mean, I sort of have got a good detector for when people are being truthful and when they're just sort of trying to pull the wool over my eyes because they don't want a particular fact in the newspaper. You'd be surprised at the sort of things that people... I had a publicist once who represented Michael J. Fox. She got furious at me, and she said, you're always putting things in the paper that people, they just aren't ready to announce yet. And I said, well, those are called scoops. You know, that's the nature of the business. But most people don't. You know, most gossip columns do not stick their nose that far into people's business.
Any regrets about a story you went with that you wish you hadn't?
Many minor ones, but I really can't think of any huge story that I ran that really hurt somebody that I'm sorry I ran. I mean, I once heard from, after in the 84 elections, I ran a story about some changes in John Glenn's presidential campaign staff, and apparently I found out about a year later that two people on the staff were fired after the item ran. They were accused of being the leaks for it, and I felt really bad about that because it wasn't that huge a story. If I'd known people were going to lose their jobs, I never would have run it. But nothing so awful that I really feel I damaged somebody's life, you know, irreparably.
Why do you love gossip? Do you love gossip?
I do like gossip. I really do. I used to, when I first started doing this, I kind of thought, should I admit to being a gossip columnist? Is this good for my reputation? But I don't think there is anybody who doesn't love gossip. And I like, it's fun to know about things as they're happening, or sometimes it seems like even before they happen. That's what half the fun of working at a newspaper and being in a newsroom, and working at gossip column is a part of that.
When you're going to a party and you're on duty, you're going especially to see what you can find out about the people who are there.
Right.
How do you go about doing it?
A lot of parties, if I cover a party and I'm writing about the party itself, I might literally take a notebook out and go around and get quotes from people. I've done that at the Swifty Lazar Oscar party, which I've covered a couple times in California. But if I'm just going there on the chance that something might happen, or maybe I'm trying to cultivate a few new sources, I make sure that I introduce myself to people when I'm talking to them, make sure they know that I write for a newspaper. Because if I'm standing there, I've been in situations where I overhear this unbelievable, people start talking to me and telling me this stuff that would make a great story, but if they have no idea who I am, it's really not very fair. So I say, oh, I write for a newspaper, you know, would you mind if I looked into that as an item? And sometimes they'll have a fit and say, oh my God, no, you can't do that. And other times they go, sure, just don't tell anybody who told you. In that case, you know, it works out fine. But I don't really cover that many parties sort of with my notebook out. Most of the time I'm there. Parties are I don't do that much party coverage. It's more as a way to cultivate new sources and meet new people than it is for actual party information. Although some of these, like the Swifty Lazar Oscar party, is just unbelievably star-studded and is quite amazing. So I've written about that the times that I've been to it.
When a celebrity's at a party that you're at and they're drunk and make a fool of themselves, what do you do? Do you cover it or not?
No, I don't. I was at a party where I saw an actress, an older woman who apparently has a drinking problem, and she was completely smashed and she was making a fool out of herself. But I mean, it was like a very sorry spectacle. I didn't really think it was my place to cover it. I don't know, people who are listening to this program probably think, well, doesn't she write about anything good, like people getting drunk or cheating on their wives? And there's a way to do certain things. I wouldn't do it. I felt really bad for it. I didn't really think it was my place to cover it. I guess I could have, and maybe somebody else would have, but anyway, I didn't.
So if you're not writing about that, what is your idea of the perfect story?
The perfect story.
Mm-hmm.
It has to have a big name in it. That's, you know, one of the ones that's tough to write about, a Greta Garbo or a Jackie Onassis. It has to have an element of humor in it, either in the writing or in the person doing something that's humorous. Maybe even something that's a little bit knocks them down to a human level. Like one of my favorite Donald Trump stories is the fact that everybody writes about what a huge bestseller his book was. Well, I like even better the fact when the book came out, Trump sort of enlisted the aid of several friends of his to buy up large lots of the book to kind of guarantee the fact that it was going to be on the bestseller list, showing that even Donald Trump is slightly insecure. I mean, that to me was a great story, because it really sort of, his ego is so inflated and so overblown and out of control that to sort of show that he was a little bit human too. That was a good story.
Okay, I want to thank you very much
for
talking with us. My guest has been Susan Mulcahy, and she writes about gossip. She edits the Inside New York page in New York Newsday, used to edit the infamous Page 6 column in the New York Post, and she's written a new memoir titled My Lips Are Sealed, Confessions of a Gossip Columnist. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll have a live concert of stride piano, bebop, and American popular song with jazz pianist and singer Harry Connick Jr. He began performing in public in New Orleans when he was 5 and went on to study with Ellis Marsalis. Now at age 20, he's released his first solo album. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Michael Tolkien's screenplays have been rejected by several studios. How mad is he? Well, not as mad as the rejected screenwriter of his first novel, who threatens to kill the producer who promised to get back to him and never did. Coming up, I talk with Michael Tolkien. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews director Peter Sellers' staging of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. It's set on the 54th floor of Manhattan's Trump Tower. And guest commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews The Case Against the SAT, a new book critical of the scholastic aptitude tests. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A federal judge in Jacksonville, Florida, today sentenced convicted Colombian drug smuggler Carlos Lader to two consecutive life terms plus 15 years in prison. In handing down the sentence, U.S. District Judge Howell Melton said Lader's penalty was a signal to society. Lader was convicted in May of smuggling more than 3 million tons of cocaine into the United States. He was the reputed leader of the Medellin drug cartel, said to be responsible for 80% of the cocaine imported to this country. The State Department announced today that the governments of Angola, Cuba, and South Africa have agreed to a U.S.-mediated set of principles to end their conflict in Southwest Africa. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Chester Crocker says the 14 principles will serve as a set of guidelines for future negotiations between Angola, Cuba, and South Africa. The three countries have agreed to abide by United Nations Security Council Resolution 435, which calls for the independence of Namibia. They also agreed to a phased withdrawal of Cuban troops from Angola. The other principles call for respect for the territorial integrity of Southwest African nations and pledges of non-interference in the internal affairs of those countries. Secretary Crocker says the details of timetables, verification, and disengagement remain to be negotiated.
The job ahead is a very major one. This is an important step. We are not saying that it's more than that. What it does is to clear the way for the hard bargaining that lies ahead on a number of very specific issues.
Those talks are scheduled to resume August 2nd in Geneva. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Despite appeals for restraint, Iraq's ambassador to Washington said his country would continue fighting until a ceasefire in the Gulf War is formally declared. UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar announced today he's sending a team to Iran and Iraq to arrange details for the ceasefire. Anne Garrels has this report.
Perez de Cuellar expects the team to report back in a week. At that point, he plans to announce what he calls D-Day, the day the ceasefire will go into effect. Perez de Cuellar will also set dates for the exchange of prisoners and a panel to investigate responsibility for the war. Today, in a letter to the UN Secretary General, Iraq proposed direct negotiations with Iran. Later today, Iran rejected direct talks. Iraq also proposed a number of steps not included in Resolution 598, which Iraq's ambassador to Washington said were essential for a ceasefire. Among them, a request that the UN clear the Shatt al-Arab waterway of sunken ships so that Iraq would once again have access to the Gulf. Disputes over the ownership of the waterway led to the outbreak of the war. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
At the Democratic Convention in Atlanta, Michael Dukakis and Jesse Jackson are continuing their efforts to keep good relations between the two campaigns. Today was no exception, as NPR's Jim Angle reports.
Dukakis, Jackson, and Senator Benson met this afternoon for half an hour, accompanied by several members of each campaign staff. A spokesman said there was no set agenda for the meeting, that the group just chatted about the fall campaign. The details of Jackson's role in the Dukakis campaign have not yet been established, though a number of his staffers are expected to move to the Dukakis camp. After the two candidates left, the members of their two campaign staffs remained behind to chat and get to know one another, according to a Dukakis spokesman. This morning, Dukakis called Reverend Jackson to compliment him on last night's speech to the convention, which he called terrific, and to tell Jackson how proud he must be of his children, who appeared together to introduce their father for last night's speech. I'm Jim Angle in Atlanta.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 13 points today to close at 2110.6. Advances led declines 4-3 on volume of 152 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange rose 16 cents. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. What is Figaro doing in Trump Tower, the Manhattan high-rise where the rich live and shop? Well, director Peter Sellers put him there in an updated version of Mozart's opera The Marriage of Figaro. Sellers has already staged Mozart's Così fan tutte and Don Giovanni in contemporary settings. This new production of Figaro recently received its American premiere at the PepsiCo Summer Fair in Purchase, New York. The opera was written in the 18th century. Figaro is the servant of a count. His bride-to-be, Susanna, is the servant of the countess. The count wants to exercise his aristocratic right to deflower Susanna on her wedding night. The opera is about how the count is foiled in his plan. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has seen Sellers' new production of Figaro, and we asked him to tell us about it. Did you find that in this updating of the opera by Peter Sellers that there were aspects of the story or, you know, of the drama that were inherent in Mozart but not as explicitly stated?
Something like that. I mean, I think Peter actually, I mean, I think he could have found similar new insights in a more traditional approach. But this is his approach, and what he found are ways of seeing beneath the surface of the characters, so that some of the characters, who are usually just stereotypes, become much more real, become much more touching. But I'm not sure it's simply because of the updating or because he's really looked at the text and looked at the music and seen something that not just more traditional directors, but that directors who aren't as insightful haven't seen before. He does something else that I think I am convinced is in the opera, though maybe Mozart, you know, might not have been able to talk about it. And it has something to do with the relationship among the women. They're very aware of their identities as women. Even the men are aware of the sort of mystery of what it is to be a woman. There's a beautiful duet, the letter duet, in which Susanna and the Countess are planning to trap the Count later on. And it's always a very, very lovely number. It's done much more slowly in this production. And instead of the sort of traditional, realistic, theatrical staging, Sellers has them go into a kind of formal dance, almost, in which they're bending and turning, and they even fall on the floor at the same time. It's almost a kind of ritual of connectedness between the two.
You've brought an excerpt of the scene that you're talking about.
I did.
Confuses me. Sellers has taken this 18th century opera, set it in the present so that it has a resonance to people in the 20th century that it wouldn't otherwise have. But it's still being sung in Italian, so I don't quite get it. I mean, if I went to see it, I still wouldn't understand what the heck they were singing about, even though it was set in the Trump Towers.
Right. Well, the staging is... Some of the staging is so good that you can follow it anyway. I personally admire his decision to do it in Italian because I think it sounds better, it fits the music better.
Uh-huh.
And I think his main intention is not to find some sort of jazzy new gimmick that's going to you know, that's going to get a lot of laughs. He will get some laughs. He will get some laughs that aren't in the original. But that what he's doing, that there's a kind of musical sensitivity, a sensitivity to the style of the music, to the tone, to the mood of the music, that you don't often get in opera productions these days. And that if he has to do it by going the route of updating, well, then that's okay. It's okay with me because he's hitting much deeper pay dirt. It's not just a kind of superficial, oh, you know, let's set the Marriage of Figaro in the Civil War or, you know, in World War I.
Lloyd, what's the life of a reinterpreted classic? Can you see anybody else doing the Peter Sellers staging of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro? Or does it just end with Peter Sellers?
Well, end isn't quite the word because he'll tinker with it. He'll do it again. It's being planned for production again next summer. I'm sure he's going to make lots of changes. He'll see all sorts of new things. The singers will see new things in them. And I think this is Peter Sellers is just beginning to work on Figaro. And I think he thinks that it's an inexhaustible masterpiece and that he'll keep coming back to it.
Okay, well, Lloyd, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Peter Sellers' Figaro will be performed at the PepsiCo Summer Fair through July 31st. This is Fresh Air. Griffin Mill is the vice president of production at a major Hollywood studio. He knows about ambition, power, money, greed, and the tastes of the American people. Griffin Mill is the main character in Michael Tolkien's first novel, The Player. Mill is based on all the studio executives Tolkien has met since he began writing screenplays 10 years ago. As a screenwriter, Tolkien has pitched a lot of story ideas, most of which have been turned down. In his novel, one rejected screenwriter seeks revenge and sends threatening postcards to Hollywood executive Griffin Mill.
Dear Griffin, I'm still waiting for you to call. You said you'd get back to me. My answering machine is on all the time, so you can't say that you called, but I wasn't in. I told you my idea, you said you wanted to think about it, and you said you'd get back to me. My agent said that was a good sign, the part about getting back to me. I've waited long enough. You lied to me. It's obvious you have no intention of hiring me. In the name of all the writers in Hollywood who get pushed around by executives who know nothing more about movies than what did well last week and have no passion for film, I'm going to kill you.
Did you ever fantasize about writing something like that yourself?
Oh, I sent 10 of them. No, I didn't. I mean, obviously I had the fantasy, otherwise it wouldn't have come up, but the book was started because I had this fantasy of killing, right, it started with the fantasy of killing an executive, which obviously any writer is going to go through. And then I started thinking about how much the executives must hate the writers, and I inverted the idea. And at one point I had this fantasy. The original idea of the book was going to be an executive is killing unproduced writers, and he's a serial killer, but nobody ever sees the pattern because the writers are so irrelevant that the police are incapable of piecing together the pattern. But after I got to the first killing, I decided that I wanted to take it a little more seriously.
Let's see how you've imagined the screenwriter's pitch from the perspective of the film executive. Would you do a reading of that?
Sure. 3 or 4 times a week, he heard ideas from writers he didn't know. Most of them had never had a movie produced. Griffin barely remembered the names or the faces. He remembered none of the ideas more than 2 weeks old. He remembered enthusiasm, calculated optimism, and offensive cheeriness, and sometimes a sad, embarrassing panic. Yesterday, one had come in. Griffin had already forgotten his name, and he checked it on the calendar. Doug Krieger. Doug Krieger, without saying hello, launched into the story from the effect of silence after the brilliant title sequence faded to the rhythm of 100 drummers from Ghana. He was pitching some stupid African adventure story. No one would want to make it. Griffin looked at the names of other writers. Jan never gave them longer than 30 minutes. He never needed more than 15. Some tried to condense their ideas to 25 words, in and out, as they'd learned in some screenwriting class taught by someone who'd made a science of yesterday's formula. They'd talk about the arc of the story. They'd use little code words and phrases like paradigm and first act bump. They were exact. At minute 23, she finds out. What does she find out? That this movie won't get made. They talk about the rules of the genre. They'd set the scene with casting. Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep are locked in a bank vault. They combine stories. It's No Way Out meets Jagged Edge with a twist from The Searchers. They came in with big ideas, rebellion, divorce, revenge, honor. They offered atmosphere. It's sort of a red mood. It's kind of a gritty future. It's funny. Each idea represented a million adjustments to reconcile the difference between the writer's movie of his dreams, which would be the really immortal movie, that tour through the brilliant connections of his freely associating but always focused mind, and the studio's version of that dream, toward the production of which the writer conceded the banal necessity to tell a story. The writers leapt to all this accommodation in anticipation of the 30-minute audience they'd have with Griffin Mill, that chance of a lifetime to impress their pure, almost unknowable genius on the mediating taste of someone who knew what America wanted to see.
In your meetings, in the meetings you've had with film executives, what mm-hmm. has your style of pitching your screenplays been like?
Well, actually, I tend to go on too long. I pitched a script a couple of years ago. A producer and I went out and pitched the script, and he said, you know, just boil it down to 5 minutes, and I would take, you know, maybe 10 minutes, 15 minutes to tell the story. And finally, I wrote the script on spec and sold it in a day and a half, and they made the movie, and it's coming out in the fall.
Oh, so you really have a movie coming out?
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called Gleaming the Cube.
And what's it about?
It's about a Vietnamese boat child who is adopted into an Orange County, completely middle-class family, and his 16-year-old skateboard punk brothers. You're asking me to pitch the story.
Yep.
And I wrote it. It's hard for me to pitch it. Actually, I got it backwards. It's really about a 15-year-old Orange County skate punk whose family adopted a Vietnamese boat child when they were both 5 or 6 years old. The skate punk is the monster that every parent doesn't want to have, and the adopted child has become the apple of his parents' eye. The adopted child is killed, and his death is made to look like a suicide. The skateboarder has to solve the... first has to find out why his brother killed himself, finds out his brother didn't kill himself, and then has to go straight in order to solve the crime and make everything straight in the end.
That was, what, about a 40-second summary?
Yeah, but it was more than 25 words.
Right. But that's what you have to do, though, right? You have to really have it boiled down to around 40 seconds.
Yeah.
Is that true, or do you really have to do that?
You see, I think that they're right. You know, I'm on Griffin's side, at least in his contempt for the writers. I think that the truth is that the audience has a very short attention span. Any good idea should be able to boil down any movie idea to something pretty brief. And I don't know. You're asking me these questions that are hard to answer. That's really what the book is about. I don't have any pat answer. I think that if you're going to be in Hollywood at a certain point, you have to understand the game. And I wrote the book because I didn't want to write a movie. I wanted to write something that was internal and was all inside and had actually very little physical action and a lot of emotional and moral action. Gleaming the Cube ends with a 15-minute skateboard chase on the freeway. The player is different.
The vice president in your novel considers himself a player. That's the title of your book, The Player.
Yes.
And he says that the player's credo is, I love the audience, I am the audience.
Sure.
You want to explain that?
Yeah, I think that if you want to really be successful in Hollywood, you can't try to outsmart the audience. You have to have that mass taste. You have to really like big, dumb, stupid, widescreen comedies. You have to like happy endings. You have to, you know, you have to like movies about people who get diseases and everybody in the family rallies around them. You know, you have to like situation comedies and like that process. And I think that I think the executives I've seen who sort of have a kind of an attitude almost like a drug dealer's attitude, which is, you know, it's like they're not going to take it, but they'll sell it. You can't really last at that. You have to love it.
Have you tried to write screenplays solely because you think they'd be saleable, or do
you... That was Gleaming the Cube, and I did it.
That's the one that's actually got made.
That's right. And I picked up the phone and I made one phone call and sold it in about 3 days after I finished it.
Boy, you must have been really cynical after that.
No, then I sat down and didn't have another meeting for 2 years, and with the money I got from Gleaming the Cube, I wrote The Player.
Oh, I see. So this book is the result of having sold a screenplay that even you, the writer, had no respect for.
No, it's not that I didn't have any respect for it. Okay. I really liked the story that I told you, and I liked that. I liked that script. It's just that it's not a question of respect. Actually, it's really respecting the process of getting a... There's nothing harder than getting a successful movie. I mean, it's very, very difficult.
Why did you want to write screenplays in the first place?
Because I wanted to make a dent on the culture, because I'd been staring at movies all my life. The movies were really exciting and challenging and literate and emotionally complicated from the 60s up to the early 70s. And a lot of smart writers were drawn to Hollywood because it seemed like the novel was dead, and the academic novel had gone away from story and had gotten very formal and wasn't all that involving. And so the movies just seemed like the best place to go and tell stories. Actually, I was a journalist until 78, and I came out here. By the time I came out here, Rocky had already hit, and the kinds of things that I was interested in writing about were harder to sell. The other thing that's going on now is that I think that, and I'm going to be curious to see what happens with the movies, because literature, because fiction is becoming acceptable now, and I think that if I were 25 and trying to write now, I don't even know if I would have gone into the movies. I think I would have just gone straight into novels. But I did both anyway.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Tolkien's novel, The Player, is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, the co-host of All Things Considered, is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Tonight's the big night for the Democrats.
That's right. Tonight is the night that they actually nominate a candidate for president. And NPR has learned that it'll be the governor of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis.
An exclusive.
That's right. Well, we'll be hearing actually from Cokie Roberts about some of the rules changes the party has affected that might affect the next time that they have a contested race for the nomination. And also our two delegates, a Jackson delegate and a Dukakis delegate, reflect on last night's speech and what comes next.
What else are you covering?
We have an interesting feature about a town drunk from Louisiana named Elmo Alcindor.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The college potential of high school seniors is measured in part by standardized tests, including the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT, and the Advanced Placement Exam, the AP. Both of them are administered by the Educational Testing Service, the ETS, which is the largest testing company in the world. There's a new book by James Krause and Dale Trusheim called The Case Against the SAT. Guest commentator Maureen Carrigan has a review, along with some reflections on her tenure as an AP grader.
In The Case Against the SAT, James Krause and Dale Trusheim dismiss the SAT as a zero-validity supplement. Plainly speaking, they mean that the test, as a predictor of college success, can't hurt, but neither can it help. High school grades, which are available to students and admissions offices for free, are equally accurate. Their own findings disturb the authors. As academics, even worse, social scientists, they believe in testing. So, desperate for a more precise test, they embrace the AP exam. Unlike the SAT, which claims to measure innate aptitude, the AP grills students on specific course material in subjects like history, physics, and calculus. But Krause and Trusheim overlook the assembly line way the AP is graded. For 3 years, I graded AP exams. My experiences should discourage anybody from describing the AP as precise. Every June, ETS hires some 400 high school and college English teachers to grade AP exams. At last year's session, we were divided into groups of 8. We breakfasted at 7, then began grading. Twice a day, bells summoned us to sugar and caffeine breaks. Threats kept us on schedule. As one ETS foreman warned a room full of graders, "If you get back 1.5 minutes late from the breaks, you lose 2 man-hours per room per day." For 7 hours a day, my team read students' essays on a selection of books that advocate social change. Other groups graded a snoozer on Sylvia Plath's Sow, an obscure poem filled with suckling images. On average, we graded 200 exams per day, spending a minute or two on each. Too fast? Not for us. We had become practitioners of what ETS calls holistic grading. It's a system so advanced you could grade by smell alone. Holistic grading permits teachers to grade essays on books they don't know. I graded hundreds of essays on Tartuffe and Redburn, neither of which I've read. ETS's methods for turning mere teachers into holistic graders owe a lot to mush-brained New Age nostrums like Est, the watchful table eaters, the ration bathroom breaks, and worst of all, the filmy language. "What does the essay feel like to you?" our leader would ask as we shared our grades. We quickly learned the unspoken guidelines. Semicolons and good penmanship raise even a lousy essay score. After reading thousands of essays, my own crack grading team caught the giggles. Bad. We read, for instance, that The Jungle, Upton Sinclair's expose of the meatpacking industry, was really a novel about black pride. Not all the howlers came from students. A friend heard one grader ask his reader, "What makes this kid so sure the sow is female?" At the deprogramming session that ended the AP grading, we learned that over 250,000 essays had been graded in 5.5 days. Despite ETS's glee, this wasn't a figure to be proud of. It represented the output of tired people grading according to guidelines they didn't understand or respect. Krauss and Trusheim's book encourages readers to see precision in a testing system that insiders know is a sham. The testing commissars are blinded by what they can see.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Bryn Mawr College and reviews books for The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, writer Tom Dish speaks affectionately about his toaster. Dish likes the appliance so much, he made it the hero of his book, The Brave Little Toaster. In the sequel, he sends the toaster to Mars. Also, heavy metal on record and film. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews recent recordings by bands in the Monsters of Rock tour. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 2, The Metal Years. It's a documentary about today's top metal bands. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of Philadelphia's business and cultural district.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.